Last week, Synthevoice, the company that produces the Window Bridge screen reader, announced the death of its founder, David Costishan, a true pioneer in the assistive technology industry. Today on Main Menu, we're going to spend some time paying tribute to David Costishan. You'll hear David talking about the history of Synthevoice in his own words, and it's a remarkable history. But first, we're going to speak with Neil Jarvis of the UK, who in the past has been involved in the support of Window Bridge in the UK. Neil, welcome to the program, and it's a sad occasion that we have to talk to you about today. David Costishan, he was a pioneer, wasn't he? No doubt about it.
He certainly was. He was right there at the beginning of screen access technology for blind people. Synthevoice is a company that had been going for, what, nearly 20 years? They brought out hardware devices to work under DOS. They brought out an extremely good DOS screen reader in the 80s, right at the very beginning. And then, of course, they were the very first people to bring out a Windows screen reader.
And that was at a time when people were still fearful that it just couldn't be done. Not even an argument, really, about the kind of access that we were going to be getting, but just that it may not even be possible. And yet they did it. They just came out and did it out of the blue, in some respects, really.
It was very unexpected. I remember clearly the day that it was announced that Window Bridge was out, and it was like, oh, yes, what is this going to be like? And it was quite rough and ready, of course, in the early days, as all initial screen readers for Windows were, but you could get around, and you could certainly do your work. And it was a fine program. It crashed quite a bit, but then that was unusual for Windows 3.1.
Yes, and if you had certain synthesizers, you had to go through all sorts of hoops just to get the thing to work. But it did work. And I remember actually calling in from New Zealand to download that program, the first ever Window Bridge demo off the Synthevoice BBS in Canada. Must have been a 96K connection at that stage. It took a while. But tell us about how you felt when you typed that win command, and instead of just no speech, suddenly it sprang into life and you got some audible feedback.
That was one of its strengths, wasn't it, Jonathan? I mean, one of the big things about Window Bridge was that it was the only screen reader around that actually had a simultaneous support for DOS and Windows.
Yes.
Which was quite extraordinary, in actual fact. It did carry with it quite a serious overhead in terms of system resources and things, and that became more of a minus towards the end than a plus. But for most of the time of its life, it was a serious plus, because as you say, there you were at a DOS prompt, you typed your win command, and you could actually tell what was going on while Windows was loading. It was spectacular. And then you got into the actual Windows operating system, and it still talked. And it was quite a magical feeling, because as you say, a lot of us had been told over and over again that we'll never have access to Windows. Well, it proved that wasn't the case.
At what point in Window Bridge's life did you feel that a professional who may have been dependent on Windows to get their job done in the workplace could actually function in Windows sufficiently?
I would say certainly from Window Bridge version 2, which was, 94, 95, still a little ropey, but professionals certainly could work quite well then. And then, for me, the golden number was Window Bridge version 2.21. That just seemed to do so many wonderful things. It supported software speech through the Sound Blaster. No one had done that before, and it did it really well. And we were working in Word and Excel and even the CompuServe Windows program, you know, that sort of thing. And it was great. It worked extreme well, and it was very configurable. So if it didn't work for you then, and you knew how to work with the tools that came with the program, then you certainly were able to make it talk even better than it was already doing.
And
I think we're looking at 95, 96 at that point.
Yes, they continued to have first. As I recall, they were the first to come out with a screen reader for Windows 95 and for the whole NT operating system as well, I think.
They weren't the first for NT, but they were certainly the first for 95, as I understand. They held back with NT for a while because of it took a while to develop. I mean, as users, a lot of us were crying out for an NT system. But quite rightly, and I think that other manufacturers could take note of it, they said, look, we want to get it right before we release it.
The interface was quite unique, really, wasn't it? It still is. I mean, and one of the things that they did, which I see JAWS has now adopted, is that Window Bridge 2000 was the first screen reader to look at using the caps lock key as a modifier.
Yes, it was.
I remember when that came out, everybody said, my goodness, that's a weird one. And now, of course, people are choosing... on laptops are choosing to use the caps lock as their JAWS key. That was a Window Bridge idea.
It was, and in many ways, that was probably their last major first, if you like, which, as you say, was with Window Bridge 2000, which came out, nearly 2 years ago now. And it was simply that, well... Their argument had always been, we've got to find modifiers that don't conflict with Windows. Many other screen readers, and at the time, in the mid-90s, as you will recall, there were five or six screen readers around that purported to be Windows-supporting screen readers. And a lot of them had modifier keys which conflicted either with Windows or with the applications that run under Windows, and you had to do a myriad of pass-through commands to actually make the thing work properly. Well, Window Bridge always tried to avoid that and did it with a fair amount of success. And then with Window Bridge 2000, they just absolutely hit the nail on the head with the caps lock key. And it did work.
It did. Well, let's talk about, obviously, Window Bridge is a very influential product. Although, why do you think it sort of never achieved the huge market share that, say, a product like JAWS or WindowEyes has?
I think it's a combination of things, Jonathan. I think it's economies of scale come into play even in a niche market like ours. The fact that, as we all know, rehabilitation agencies and large voluntary organizations or charities in other countries tend to stick with what they know, and sometimes for very good reasons, because what they know provides them with what they need. Occasionally, perhaps, they don't always pay attention to other possibilities. And I think the problem with Window Bridge had was that it was made by a very small company. I mean, I've always said you could phone up Syntavoice and the chances are you would speak to David because
yes.
He answered the phone.
Yep.
Like everybody else did. They all took turns in doing that. So they were a small company. They did not have a huge marketing budget like some of the other companies have. And as we all know, if you want to sell your product seriously on the marketplace, you've got to sell it. You've got to market it. I don't think they were very good at that. I think they were far more interested in trying to make a good product. But if you don't sell enough units, you don't get enough return back to actually develop the product. And I suspect they got caught in that kind of downward circle, if you like.
David was very responsive, and I'd like to spend some time talking about David himself, of course.
Yeah.
But you could write to that help at Synthavoice address, and you'd get a response pretty rapidly.
Yes, and it was from him.
Yes.
It was always from... he was the one, as president of the company, who monitored the list and who actually actively took part in being the face of the company to that help list, and that was... very unusual, and it was very welcome. And of course, he knew what he was talking about. I mean, the concept of the product was his. He may not have written all the code, because that was somebody else's job. That was what Neil Cooper did.
Yes.
But he certainly had very much a major involvement in the design of the concept, and he would be able to put to you an argument for why this had happened, or that had happened, or this hadn't happened, or whatever. And you either agreed with him or you didn't agree with him, but at least you knew you were talking to the person who needed to hear.
And David and Neil Cooper were a powerful combination, really, because you had a very talented sighted engineer who could sit with David and discuss what was going on the screen.
That's
right. And then David, as a blind person, would kind of conceptualize the kind of access he felt was appropriate.
Yes. And I think that is an example which a lot of people have followed, I think, that you can get someone who really knows their business and someone who really knows what they want. That's a very good combination.
What kind of person was David Costishan?
Oh, he was a great person. He was fun. He was a nice man. He was someone who was fiercely loyal to his customers, which is why they had a very good reputation for customer support throughout most of the time that Window Bridge was around. I think he was a very decent person. He wasn't always good at taking criticism of the program. But that was because he was so wedded to making it work. But he would certainly listen, and he would argue. And he always put forward an argument that was a good argument. And you didn't always have to agree with him, but at least you felt that he genuinely was sincere about what he was saying. And you can't ask for more than that.
What do you think? I guess it's difficult to speculate about what will happen to Synth the Voice from this point on.
I don't think there's any way to know, is there? They've only just announced David's death, and I think we're all feeling it as his friends, colleagues, and contacts in the industry. But that's nothing. I can't be anything compared to what. His family are feeling, and Synth the Voice was literally his family because his brother and others were part of the company. So they must still be getting themselves together after what's happened, and I don't think at this point, if they know what's going to happen, they're obviously not telling us, and I think they need to be given space to decide that.
Sure. I think that often when we're some distance away from a company, yeah. We have this image of some great entity. In fact, when we spoke to David on Blindline about a year and a half ago,
yeah.
At that time there were only 5 people working for Synth the Voice.
That's right. That's
so
right.
So it's not a large organisation.
It's not a large organisation, at that point, when someone as absolutely critical to the running of the company and of the product is no longer with you, then obviously you're going to have time out to think what the future is. I think they might well want to try and find a way to continue the work that David did. It would be very sad if the work died with him. But of course, at the moment, that's impossible to say whether they will or they won't, and I wouldn't like to guess.
Just to close then, in the future when we look back at assistive technology history and we think of the name David Costishan, how will he be remembered?
Well, he will be remembered as the word you used at the beginning of the interview was pioneer, and that's exactly what he was. I mean, Window Bridge is in the Smithsonian Institute, isn't it, as an example of a screen access product. I don't know if all the other screen readers are in the Smithsonian, but certainly Window Bridge is. And it's in there because it was absolutely the first to bring Windows access to blind people. It was the first to bring Braille access to Windows through another screen reader, and it was the first to do so many things. And at the end, I think Window Bridge was falling behind in the screen reader race, if you like. I don't think it was keeping up with Jaws or with Window Eyes. By any stretch of imagination, they were widening the gap between themselves and the other runners like Window Bridge. But who's to know that they wouldn't have caught up again in the future and maybe taken a lead again. And certainly their track record was worn off pioneering.
Yes.
And that was down to David.
And no one will ever be able to take away from him the fact that he was the one that in fact really built the foundation on which other screen reader manufacturers could build. They invented many of the concepts that simply became universal.
Yeah, he set the benchmark, I think.
Yes.
And I think the others improved on it, perhaps. And that's often the way for people who do come up with original designs. They lead the way, and the other people who didn't have to do the hard work of inventing the original idea actually build and improve upon the product and on the idea. I think that's what's happened in the window screen reader industry. But I think without the work that David and that Synthevoice did, I don't think we'd be having such powerful screen readers as we have today.
Neil, I appreciate you coming on the program. It is a sad time for our community and, of course, for David's family, to whom we extend our deepest sympathy, and I appreciate you sharing your memories with us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Neil Jarvis, remembering David Costishan. And now on Main Menu, we're going to hear from David Costishan himself. I had the privilege of speaking with David twice on Blindline, firstly on MBS FM and then on ACB Radio. I've gone through those interviews and put together a history of Synthevoice and the amazing pioneering days of Window Bridge. Here's David Costishan to tell the story in his own words.
Synthevoice was incorporated in January of 1983. At that time, I incorporated the company after completing a few degrees in university in which I was headed toward the field of rehabilitation counseling. And prior to losing my vision in 1978, I was heavily involved in mathematics and science. And so that desire never left me. And I seemed to merge those skills and experiences along with the fact of being blind myself and the rehabilitation studies that I had undertaken, and found myself in a position where PCs were just starting to become available to the normal consumer, and I was approached and asked in how this kind of technology could possibly be modified to be used by people with special needs. And I was working for the government here at the time, and talking computers were not out yet. We were basically looking at systems that could spell but couldn't read whole words. And I was involved in some research projects for some other companies at the time. And that evolved into a full-time interest, and felt that it was something that I'd want to pursue on a full-time basis. So I left the job with the government and started Synthevoice Computers. When it was first formed, our initial objective was to design a synthesizer that could be plugged into a PC. When I first started the company, we were still working in the CPM environment, and we're using that as a development platform to write some of our code for DOS, because we didn't have a synthesizer that could run under DOS at the time, in late 82 when we first started, and 83 when we officially incorporated. Our initial objectives were to design that type of synthesizer that could be plugged in as a card into the PC, along with a DOS level screen reading program integrated into it. We produced a circuit board that originally was designed to go into Hewlett Packard HP 150 desktop computers, and at the same time we started to develop a card for the IBM PC, because no one knew at that time that the IBM PC was really going to have the magnetism that it, and gross market margin that it was going to ended up having. So we developed it on the Hewlett Packard platform and then moved it over to IBM, both running under DOS, and we wrote a screen reading program, and we introduced it as the Synthetic Language Interface Module, and came up with the abbreviation SLIM for that. And that later evolved into splitting the software to control other synthesizers, as we went through a real boom in the market in the early 80s, where more and more synthesizers were being independently developed, and people were looking for software that could control them. So we split our software away from our dedicated hardware and changed the name of the DOS product to Slimware. And eventually we moved from there into the Windows environment, and the product name moved forward into Slimware Window Bridge. Based in Canada, there was a relatively small market for the technology compared to markets like the US, And we originally felt that we should establish ourselves business-wise in our own country and then expand from there. And after several years of finally understanding that the market in Canada is spread out so far, because Canada is such a large geographic expanse, that it was extremely expensive to go from the center of the country, basically where we're located, to go to Vancouver would be a six-hour flight, or to go to the East Coast, it would be equally as far. So there were small pockets of people that were just starting to become interested in computers, but there really wasn't a concentrated population of employed blind people that would be in a type of environment where they'd be looking for PCs. And it wasn't until we pointed our direction into Europe and the UK and into the US that things started to change. Our internal little joke was we felt that we had arguably one of the best software products on the market, but it was our little secret. And we really had to find a way to market the product effectively. And once again, the marketing approach that's used in Canada is totally different than you would find in the U.S. Typically in Canada, people do not like aggressive marketing techniques. They would rather you put your effort into the quality of the product and then let the consumer decide for themselves which best meets their needs. And they do not like an in-your-face, aggressive, bold, brash sort of approach to marketing in general. But in the U.S., after taking the time to study the market more and speak with marketing people in general, they are more toward the whoever beats the drum the loudest gets the attention. And it was a difficult transition for us to start to accept that. We felt that if the quality was put into the product, the consumer would know about it and be able to decide that that's what they wanted. But it seems that you need to be more aggressive than that, and it's taken us some time to learn these types of things. We took a look at Windows 3.0 and thought that this had some possibilities, but if you recall back in 1992 or so, 1991, there was a real split in the market, whether the market was going to go toward Windows with 3.1 or if it was going to go to OS 2. And we began to research development of our product for both environments to see which one would be the most lucrative, because the general market really hadn't made a decision yet prior to 3.1 being released. And at the time, when we contacted Microsoft and said we were interested in doing something, they sent us a complimentary developer's kit. And when we contacted IBM, they wanted thousands of dollars for a complimentary developer's kit. So our first knee-jerk reaction was to take a look at the developer's kit for the product that we received at no charge, and we thought that Microsoft as a company specializing in the software area may have a tendency to take the lead in the next operating system because of the popularity of DOS itself. So we decided that if we were going to exist as a company and flourish, that we had to find something that everyone else said was basically impossible. And at the time, if you were to poll the various companies involved in developing screen readers, they all said that it could not be done, that there were too many gaps, there were too many problems. Microsoft themselves would have to be heavily involved in giving out information. And when we began to research it, we found that we could do it on our own. And essentially, we designed Window Bridge and contacted Microsoft in late May, early June of 1992, which was about 10 days after Windows 3.1 had officially been released. And we told them that we had a version for the blind. And Microsoft laughed and said, no, you mean you want to develop one? And we said, no, we have one. And they were in shock, so they asked for a copy of the program, and we shipped it down to them. And they, what really amazed them was they had never heard of us other than the request for the developer's kit, and were wondering how we figured out how to do the interface, because we hadn't gone to them and asked them a single question. We decided to do it all on our own because we felt if we crossed the line and became dependent on Microsoft or another party, then our development would be greatly affected by the time frame that they had to assist us with the project, and we would always be at their mercy. So we felt that the only way to develop a product like this would be to teach ourselves to be able to do it independently. It was released on June 15th, 1992. What was fun about the project and odd at the same time was that we had to develop a lot of concepts. We, for example, a lot of standard sorts of things that you do today, for example, the reading cursor that you see on most screen readers is tied to the movement of the mouse. The measurement of an icon that was not already identified, we chose to have it identified by the height of the icon and how many pixels high it was. There were more and more conceptual sorts of aspects to the design that we had to stop and think, all right, here's the situation. Now, you're in a screen where you cannot move a line at a time. You cannot move a word at a time because it's a scattered array of buttons and words. How would you move from one of these items to another? So we developed the concept of moving an item at a time and then being able to skip over anything that was not an icon and then just move an icon at a time and to make it just single command. So we had to develop a lot of standards because we didn't have anybody to copy. And what happened was while we were developing these standards, other companies said that this was a way of fast-tracking, and they borrowed a lot of these concepts and massaged them into fit into their own formats, and they were able to spend more time on stability and other issues because we were split between doing the off-screen model and developing concepts for navigation and identification of objects. So while it was fun to be the pioneers in certain areas, it also had a tendency to work against us. People were shocked. In fact, if we look back to some of the concepts that we implemented in the very first generation, the public insisted that the only way you could navigate the mouse pointer around the screen was with a physical device, and that they wanted not only verbal and braille feedback when you move to an object, but also they needed other orientation, such as how far they were from the left or the right, or top or bottom, how fast they were moving. So based on that, our original versions, and right up until the current versions, and the features are still there, where if you used a physical device such as a mouse, if you held the shift key, when you move, you would hear a series of ascending and descending tones. There would be one range of tones for horizontal movement and another for vertical movement, so that you could hear where you were in the audio spectrum in relation to where you were to the edge of the window or the edge of the screen. And if you were moving in a skewed manner, you would hear both sets of tones playing back to let you know that you were moving on an angle. But to allow the user to move in a straight line, we had a keyboard command that would lock into vertical or horizontal tracking, that if you used a physical mouse and traveled and moved up and down, even if you could not physically move in a straight line, we would lock the mouse pointer to make sure it was guided perfectly straight. We wanted to navigate directly from the keyboard, and the public said, you can't do that. It has to be with the mouse, because that's the way sighted people do things. So we we pursued both approaches simultaneously. We developed our mouse pad for moving lines, words, characters, items, and icons at a time, clicking the left and right mouse button from the numeric pad, and using the same orientation to the keys as the IBM orientation for navigating a normal DOS or a Windows insertion pointer. But at the same time, we had to pursue the support of touch screens and with audio and braille feedback, and also using a tracking ball or a mouse. My job was primarily in the design area. My programming skills were just self-taught, and they're nowhere near what's required to do programming of this level of sophistication. But we have a very talented engineer in the office by the name of Neil Cooper, who really did not have experience with the blind, but could interpret any designs and concepts that were given to him and then make it work that way. So my part of the design was to say, here is the key or key combination on the keyboard. Here is how it has to feel to the user. It's positioned here and works in combination with these other related commands so that the user knows that there are a group of commands that are physically related to each other in the same place on the keyboard. And then, since I couldn't see, there were a number of activities and things that were happening in the Windows screen that I wasn't aware of, and yet Neil could interpret those and give that information to me and say, you also need to be able to handle this situation and that situation. So the two of us would collaborate, and basically between the two of us, we came up with the design. And at the same time, I was being taught the technical ins and outs of Windows for things that I had never been exposed to in my life. DOS was so easy compared to this at first. It just seemed overwhelming that you now had to deal with exploding windows, and windows that the same window wouldn't always appear in the same location on the screen, and it would overlap and partially cover other windows, and the highlights weren't really highlights. They were different color combinations, and as video resolutions were going through their growth process, we weren't dealing with 16 colors anymore. We were dealing with 16 million, and we not only had to think of the character itself, but there were so many other things. We needed to know the point size. We needed to know the font. All of this information, being in a WYSIWYG type of environment, was now relevant to the user. And we had to come up with ways of portraying that information without overwhelming the blind user. If you move to a character, you didn't want to be told the position of the character itself, the color of the foreground, the color of the background, the point size, and any other attributes all at once. That would be too overwhelming to the user. So we had to take a look at whether we had filters that turned on and off, or that we had different commands that would give you selective feedback that you could choose from. So all of these designs were not required in a DOS environment, but became imperative to using Windows.
We salute David Karsishin, a blind man with vision, a man who led the way, a man who proved that it could be done when many people said it could not.